All right, well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here. And I'll be talking about my most recent work, which is kind of in progress. So I have done one step, and there's still more to be done. I'll talk about that at the end. But nonetheless, I think there are some interesting results to share. So first, I'll give a very brief introduction. And then I'll spend some time on homogeneous loop quantum cosmology. So I'll be reviewing some of the more basic stuff. So please stop me if you have any questions. And then for the second half of the talk, I'll explain how we include scalar perturbations. And then I'll end with the results and an outlook. All right, so everyone here knows that the main goal of quantum gravity is to combine the theories of GR and quantum mechanics. And we also know that since quantum gravity effects are only important in extreme situations, it's very hard to test. So for example, in accelerators, we don't see a possibility of testing quantum gravity anytime soon. Now, my opinion is that cosmology is our best chance to test the theory. So what I suggest, what I think is the best way to do this, is to make predictions from loop quantum gravity and get these predictions in the cosmological setting and compare to observations, both of the cosmic microwave background and hopefully eventually of primordial gravitational waves. So I think this really is our best chance to test the theory. And so I think we should put a fair amount of effort moving forward in this direction. Now, my talk today will focus on loop quantum cosmology. And so to do this, if we want to compare loop quantum cosmology with the cosmic microwave background, we have to understand how scalar perturbations behave in loop quantum cosmology. And what we've seen in the CMB, the cosmic microwave background, is that the spectrum of your scalar perturbations are almost scale invariant with a slight redshift. And so we need to be able to reproduce this result. And this can be explained by introducing matter fields. So this is done, for example, in inflationary and ekparotic scenarios. But there are also other ways to do it. So there are two things we need to do to test LQC. First, we need to see how, assuming inflation or the ekparotic model is one we're interested in, how loop quantum cosmology effects affect the subleading terms. So we want to calculate corrections to the leading order effects. But also, perhaps loop quantum cosmology alone, without any extra matter field input, gives what we're looking for, gives a scale invariant spectrum with a slight redshift. This, of course, is speculation.
When you say shift, you mean field.
Yes, sorry.
Yes, sorry.
What was I saying? Yes, so perhaps that does it alone, but this is speculation. We need to look at the equations in order to see if this happens or not. But in any case, we do want to know for sure what subleading corrections would be from the inflationary or ekparotic models. OK, so I'll start with the homogeneous case, just so that we're all on the same footing, and then I'll go on to perturbations afterwards. So we have the line element for our homogeneous and isotropic model. And in loop quantum gravity, our variables are holonomies of the Aschauer connection, which is given, I'm not sure what that's happening. Which is given by the spin connection plus the extrinsic curvature. And in the FLRW space-time, you can parameterize this by one variable C, which is just proportional to A dot. Also, our other variables are the fluxes of densitized triads. And since this corresponds to areas, this is the scale factor squared. And we'll parameterize that by P. OK. So these two variables are canonically conjugate. And with the choice of variables that we made, you can show that the Gauss and diffeomorphism constraints are automatically satisfied. So we can drop those, and we'll just focus on the Hamiltonian, on the scalar constraint, which is given here. So we have the densitized triad. We have the field strength of the Aschauer connection. We have the field strength of the spin connection. For the flat FLRW model, this term vanishes, and we're just left with the EEF term and the term from the matter field. So this is what we will quantize. OK.
Are you looking at perturbations or not?
Right now, not.
So first, I'm going to do homogeneous. Then after that, I'll add perturbations. So in loop quantum cosmology, we don't have a derivative operator corresponding to the connection. So we have to
implement operators such as the field strength, F, in a different way. And what we'll do is that we'll use the classical relation where the field strength is given by the holonomy of the connection around a loop minus the identity divided by the area of that loop. And you can take, if you take the limit of the area going to zero, then you recover the classical result, and it's exact. However, as I said, we don't have a derivative operator in loop quantum cosmology, and taking this limit, the area going to zero, would precisely give that. So since that's not well-defined, we have to choose something different. So what we do is that since the area in loop quantum, the picture in loop quantum gravity is that you have all these flux lines, which each give a certain amount of area. So the minimum area that you can get is if you take the holonomy around only one flux line like this, and this will give you your minimal area. So what we'll do is that we'll take a holonomy around a square loop, and we'll choose the area of the square loop to be the minimal eigenvalue in loop quantum gravity. And then we'll put that back as our operator into the Hamiltonian constraint. Okay? Now, when you do that, you get this Hamiltonian constraint operator here. And we have a massive scalar field phi. And you can see that acts as a time variable. And so we'll use that to deparameterize the theory. And we also notice that we have a difference equation rather than a differential equation. Here I'm using the variable nu, which is like a cubed rather than p, just to simplify the notation. And so this is the main difference from the Wheeler-DeWitt theory in quantum cosmology. There you'd have a differential equation. Here, because we don't have a differential operator for the connection, we have a difference equation instead. And so that's the main difference that we have. Now, most of you have seen this, so I'll go through this figure very quickly. What you have here is that you have the green line, which is the classical solution. So you have a very large universe, which collapses into the Big Bang singularity in the past. Or you have a very large universe in the past, which collapses into a Big Crunch singularity in the future. And these two solutions don't talk to each other. What happens in loop quantum cosmology is that there's a bounce between the two. And what happens is that if you have a large universe at late times, it contracts, follows GR very closely up until this scale here, where quantum gravity effects become important, there's a strong repulsive force, and then the universe starts to expand again. And one thing which I want to point out is that the spread remains small. So here, if you start with a state which is sharply peaked, as you follow its evolution, it'll remain sharply peaked throughout the evolution, including at the bounce point when quantum gravity effects are very important. And we'll take full advantage of this. Are there any questions so far? Yes?
So this phi is a massless scalar field?
Yes.
So, I mean, the massless scalar field, I mean, its evolution isn't necessarily monotonic, is it?
It is. Well, in FLRW, it is.
But you're taking it to be time, so.
Yes. Yes.
But I'm curious, if you add quantum fluctuations, I don't see how it could be monotonic, because, I mean, it's a quantum object, so it would go back and forth.
Right, here we've deparameterized, so that doesn't happen. But if you don't want to deparameterize, then you could have effects like that. Then you have to use relational observables.
Yeah.
But if you have something which is sharply peaked, it'll behave in a relatively nice way. If you choose a wave function which isn't sharply peaked, then you can have a whole host of other issues coming up.
Okay.
Anything else? Okay. Okay, so now we'll take advantage of the fact that this wave function remains sharply peaked throughout in order to introduce effective dynamics. So what you can see on the previous slide is that the quantum dynamics here can be quite well approximated
by a classical trajectory, which is corrected here in this region. But if you know the classical trajectory which follows that, that's a very good approximation of the full quantum theory. And so that's what we'll do. Now, what happens is that typically you have this Hamiltonian, and this red term here is just c squared. So in order to incorporate the quantum gravity effects, you replace c by sine of mu bar c divided by mu bar, where mu bar is Planck scale divided by p, and then you take the square root of that. And this way, you incorporate your quantum gravitational effects. So if the scale of your model is much larger than the Planck scale, then you just have c squared here, and it behaves classically. However, once the space-time curvature reaches the Planck scale, then this departs significantly from c squared, and you'll get some quantum gravity effects. So, for example, you can obtain the first modified Freeman equation just by using Poisson brackets, and you find that you get this relationship. So you have the classical relationship, where the Hubble rate is 8 pi g over 3 times the energy density. Then you have this quantum correction term, which is 1 minus rho over rho c. And rho c is your critical energy density, and that's where the bounce occurs. And you can also see that if your energy density is much smaller than the Planck energy density, then this term is completely negligible. So this is what you're dealing with. OK. Now, you can do this for all of the equations. So we already showed the first one. But you also have the Ricciarduri equation. And here there is a correction to the second term, to the matter term again. And the equation governing the conservation of energy remains the same. Now, what I want to point out before going on is that what I did is that I put in a modification on the gravitational side of the action. It just so happens that you can use the equations of motion and put all of the corrections on the matter side. But that doesn't change the fact that the fundamental modifications really were on the gravitational side. This is just a simple way to write the equations that include all the corrections due to quantum gravity effects. Yes?
Is there a simple way to see that the conservation of energy is not modified by quantum corrections?
No, there isn't. You just have to work it out. For example, we'll see later on that the perturbations, the conservation of energy is modified. So it's only for the homogeneous case that it's not modified. Although, in some sense, it's minimally modified. So it does seem to be, you know, the other equations are much more modified than that one. But there's no simple way that I know of to see that. Any other questions? OK. Now I'm going to briefly talk about the types of corrections that you expect in loop quantum cosmology, which are holonomy and inverse triad corrections. So far, in homogeneous models, the effects that are due to inverse triad corrections, in the full quantum theory here I'm speaking, are negligible if the physical volume of the manifold is large compared to the Planck length, or the Planck volume, sorry, at the bounce point. So for example, if you have a non-compact space, then clearly its physical volume diverges, and and the effects due to inverse triad corrections vanish. Now, it's been suggested that this is because inverse triad operators aren't properly implemented in loop quantum cosmology. And this is very possible. But it's not clear how to fix this. So right now, I'm just going to focus on holonomy corrections for the rest of the talk. And on the previous slide here, I was only including holonomy corrections. So if you include inverse triad corrections in a compact model, there will be additional corrections here. But they're subleading so long as your universe is large at the bounce point, typically. So I'm studying the flat model, but you can do it in the curved model as well.
And do you know how it would look like?
Yes. Yes, I can show you. It's a bit more complicated,
okay.
But you can do it. Okay, so for the remainder of this talk, I'll continue to only consider holonomy corrections for the perturbations as well. Now, since we want to study, want to compare the predictions of loop quantum cosmology to the CMB, we need to be able to describe the dynamics of scalar perturbations. And there's been a lot of work studying inverse triad corrections to these perturbations in the effective setting, because these turn out to be easier to implement at the effective level. Now, because we don't fully understand the quantum corrections, I'm not sure how much we can learn from studying them at the effective level. But since we do understand the holonomy corrections quite a bit better, I think we should try to implement holonomy corrections for perturbations, and especially for scalar perturbations, since those are the ones that we see in the CMB. Now, there are two main difficulties, which I'll just sketch. The first one is obvious. So in your homogeneous models, you have a mini superspace. So you can deal with quantum mechanics, and quantization is very simple. Now, if you allow perturbations, you have a quantum field theory setting, and of course, becomes considerably more difficult. So that's one. But even more complicated is that your degrees of freedom change. So in the homogeneous case, your holonomies turn out to be almost periodic functions of the connection. And this is very easy to deal with. But as soon as you allow perturbations, this is no longer the case. So it becomes a lot more difficult to develop the quantum theory for this. So these are the two main difficulties, I think, of including the doing full loop quantum cosmology treatment when there are perturbations. So what I'll do is I'll show you how we can skip around this difficulty by choosing a nice appropriate gauge. So in the longitudinal gauge, and here we'll assume that the matter field has zero anisotropic stress, the metric has this form. And here, so A is still your scale factor, and you have this variable psi, which encodes your perturbations around both the scale factor and the lapse, which I've chosen to be one here. And the main point that I want you to take away from this gauge is that the spatial metric, if you just look at this part here, it looks exactly like the FLRW metric. There are no diagonal, off-diagonal terms or anything like that, except that now your scale factor varies on position as well as time. And so what we can do is that we can break our manifold up into a lattice, and we can assume that each cell in the lattice is homogeneous. Yes?
You don't have gravitational degrees of freedom itself. You don't have spin 2 degrees of freedom.
That's right. So here I'm only looking at scalar perturbations. So to have your tensor modes, you'd have additional degrees of freedom. And then it wouldn't be diagonal anymore. So you'd have some off-diagonal terms. And then that would make it a lot more complicated. And that's important if you want to look at primordial gravitational waves, for example. But here I'll just consider the CMB, so scalar modes are enough. Anything else? OK. And so what you can do is that you can take your manifold and discretize it and view each cell as being homogeneous and isotropic. And we know how to quantize or do a loop LQC treatment of these homogeneous and isotropic cells. And then what's left to do is to allow interactions so you can see how these homogeneous isotropic cells interact with each other. And so this is what we want to do. So, here we're going to, well, so part of it is gone because we're looking at really this metric. So we're gauge fixing there, and there's only one spatial diffeomorphism left. And that then will have to do with differences between adjoining cells.
So why don't you go ahead and gauge fix all of those spatial diffeomorphisms if you can gauge fix two out of three?
Sorry, I didn't explain myself properly. Here it's linearized, so you have the linear version, which is simpler. But you still have your I messed that properly. So you still have your three XYZ spatial diffeomorphisms. But it's linearized, so it's a very simple form.
Okay.
And then it just has to do with differences between neighboring cells.
So you have a quantum constraint that you're going to impose?
Yes.
And it's linear, so they commute with each other?
Yes.
Well, let's see.
Yes, I think so. Okay. So as I said, we'll discretize the manifold. And we'll assume that each cell is homogeneous and do the standard LQC treatment.
in that particular cell. Then we do that, and then we'll introduce the interactions between the neighboring cells. But to do this, we need to be able to get the Hamiltonian for linear perturbations in variables which are suited for LQC. And the variables that are suited for LQC are C and P still, as they were before, but now they depend on position. Now, the problem is these aren't variables that are commonly used in cosmological perturbations. So you need to redo the whole classical theory in terms of these variables. So the first step that we'll do is to do this, which will be entirely classical. And then what we'll find is that the Hamiltonian can be split into two terms. One is an ultra-local term with no divergences, with no derivatives, sorry. And we call that the homogeneous term. And this is exactly the term that you have for your FLRW metric, for the homogeneous and isotropic case. So we know how to deal with that. Then there's also an interaction term. And this term is a little bit more complicated. And this has to do with the interactions between neighboring cells in your lattice. But we can also deal with that one. So we'll do the standard LQC quantization of the homogeneous term, because we know it very well. And then we'll quantize the interaction term in the simplest consistent manner. And here, to simplify things, I won't really talk about the quantum theory. I'm going to jump straight to the effective theory. So if you remember, the full quantum theory, at least in the homogeneous case, is very well approximated by the effective dynamics. So here I'll just show how to incorporate the corrections and the effective equations rather than going through the full quantum theory. Yes? Yes.
The way you should have a bundle of Hamiltonian constraints.
Right. So you have one constraint at each cell, but also
maybe you're going to,
because you gauge fixed, your lapse has to be this. So you can't choose any lapse. Right?
Size to the field.
Yeah, so I'll show that in a second, but you can, so your lapse, in order for this gauge to hold as you evolve with time, you have to choose your lapse n as a function of p. So if you choose a different lapse, then your Hamiltonian has to have a more complicated form because you're moving away from this gauge and you'll have off-diagonal terms which will appear. And then if you have that, then you don't know how to do the LQC treatment, because the metric in one homogeneous cell is no longer diagonal. And then even if it's homogeneous, just not being diagonal means it's not almost periodic. The holonomies are no longer almost periodic functions of your connection.
So you can't really go back to a formalism where you add constraints and gauge fixes?
No. There's a lot of gauge fixing that's done here. But what happens in the quantum theory, which I won't be talking about today, what happens is that you do have two Hamiltonian, you can take Hamiltonian constraints, and since you only have one lapse you can use for them, you can still calculate the commutator. And that will give you your diffeomorphism constraint. So normally you have your constraint algebra, which depends on your Lagrange multipliers, and you can choose them freely. Here you no longer have that. But you still do have a smaller algebra. So for example, H commutator with H will give you the diffeomorphism constraint in a very specific way. So you don't have the freedom to change your Lagrange multipliers, but you still have some information left over. Yes?
So are you discretizing sort of according to fixed co-moving volumes?
Yes.
And so these will be sort of cells that are growing along with the cosmology. So does the fact that you have this sort of volume associated with those cells as well as this kind of minimal volume that you get from LQC.
Right.
So there's some physical effect.
So these are two completely different things.
Yeah.
So you can think of the cell, which I'm introducing here to describe the homogeneities, as something entirely classical. So if I want to study perturbations on a computer, I'll discretize and I'll introduce a lattice. And this is entirely classical. So I'm doing something similar here. Now, the minimal volume is completely different. That's something, here what I would argue is that your minimal volume is that when the volume of one of your cells changes, it's because you've added one minimal volume are taken away, one minimal volume of your fundamental Planck size. But this is very heuristic. But the point is those two things are entirely separate.
But at the end of the day, the physics should be independent on your choice of discretization scale.
Almost. Because I'm interested in perturbations, I need to make sure that my discretization scale is fine enough to model the perturbations I'm interested in. Right? So if I'm interested in perturbations of some wave number, let's say 10, then I need to make sure that I have a lattice which is, say, 10 by 10 by 10. So I can model waves like that.
Can you take the continuum limit?
Yes, and I'll do that here. And then you get everything back. Yeah. The continuum is much easier to take in the effective theory. In the quantum theory, I've been thinking about that, but I'm not sure how to do it yet. Anything else? OK. OK, so I think I was here. So the point is, first, we will obtain the Hamiltonian, the classical Hamiltonian, for scalar perturbations. But in terms of these new variables, which aren't usually used for cosmological perturbations, but which are very useful for loop quantum cosmology. Then once we have that, we will split the Hamiltonian into your homogeneous term and the interaction term. And then we'll do the standard LQC quantization of the homogeneous term and add in the interactions afterwards. OK. So in the longitudinal gauge, you can check and see that your lapse is 1 plus psi, and your shift is 0. And also, your Gauss constraint is automatically satisfied. So all that's left is this in your Hamiltonian constraint. It gives you your evolution. Now, what we need to do now is to write the lapse in terms of our fundamental variable p. And you can do this as follows. And so your psi is written as p bar minus p over 2 p bar. And here I've introduced p bar, which is just the average of p over your entire manifold. Now, the problem here is that I'm introducing a non-local variable. So in the Hamiltonian, this p bar will appear. And we need to make sure at the end of the day that we obtain the local equations of motion, even though the Hamiltonian is non-local. So we can just think of p bar as a squared without the perturbations. But we need to make sure that at the end of the day, everything works out. Now, again, with the massive scalar field phi, your scalar constraint has this form. So you have the two terms here, which correspond to the homogeneous model. They're exactly the same. So you have your gravitational part and your matter part. Then you also have terms which depend on your interactions between neighboring cells. And so on the gravitational side, and then on the matter side here. And this is constrained to vanish to first order perturbations, which means that the sum of these three terms must be 0. These are second order, and so they're not constrained to vanish because they're second order perturbations, which we haven't included here because we're stopping at the linear level. We also have, yes, OK.
So
we also have the diffeomorphism constraint, which has this form. And you have the gravitational side here and the matter side here. Does that answer your question?
Well, I want to see I want to see how you impose that with the discretization.
So for the discretization, basically, I'm going to replace the derivative by a difference.
Right, so
between neighboring cells.
So something that can go wrong. So the Hamiltonian constraint is quadratic, and it has p and c in it, so it has an algebra. Presumably its algebra generates the linearized diffeomorphism, which is not abelian. So if you now, unless you're very lucky, if you now approximate by finite differences, the commutator or the Poisson bracket of two of these approximated by finite differences, Hamiltonian diffeomorphism constraints will not close.
Right. In general, that's correct. Here, if you choose your approximation carefully, it does. So here, what I do is I choose something as follows. So let's say partial of p at x would be p x plus 1 minus p x minus 1.
Can you write the bit larger?
Yes. Do that. So if you have this differential, then you can write this as, you can discretize it. Like that. And then for the higher order one, this one. If you choose this, then your constraint algebra closes. If you choose something else, it's not guaranteed.
You've checked that.
Yes. Yes. But it's not automatic, I agree. There's no a priori guarantee that you'll have this. So, anything else? Okay, so these are our constraints. And now, first thing I want to, yes?
So what you said right there, that's what I think is linear theory or general.
Yes. Yeah, this is linear. Yeah. So now, this is all classical, and I want to just show you the classical equations of motion. So you can see that here I have this p bar, which is appearing in the scalar constraint. And this could ruin things because it's non-local. But you can calculate the equations of motion, and you find that you get exactly what you expect, what you get, you know, your standard treatment where you use the Einstein equations. And so everything is OK. So even though you're using these unorthodox coordinates, everything works out in the end, and you get your standard local equations of motion. Just two quick comments. Of course, your initial conditions have to satisfy the constraints. And if they initially satisfy the constraints, then they'll continue to satisfy them. So your constraints are preserved by the dynamics. So if you calculate h dot or h sub a dot, you'll find zero, as long as they're initially satisfied. OK, so do you have a question?
Why are there no spatial derivatives in these equations?
There are. Yes, right here.
Five, but not for the gravitational degree.
No.
Again, if you had spin 2, there would be spatial derivatives.
Yes, I would expect so. Yeah, you should have some extra terms here. But then again, your variables would change because you can no longer write your metric in a diagonal form. So you'd have some more derivatives, but you'd have to use different variables as well. Okay, now we want to include the quantum gravity effects. And so what we'll do is that we'll start with the diffeomorphism constraint. And we want to keep the diffeomorphism, spatial diffeomorphisms as a symmetry in our theory. So we're not going to modify that at all. We're only going to modify the scalar constraint. So here, the diffeomorphism constraint and the effective equations will remain the same. It's not modified. However, for the scalar constraint, we will modify that.
And we're going to inspire ourselves from what's done in the homogeneous case. So in the homogeneous case, you take C, and you replace it by sine of mu bar C divided by mu bar. And this reproduces the main effects due to quantum gravity effects. So we'll do this first in the homogeneous part of the scalar constraint. And so we can see that this gives this here. So you have your C squared term classically, which is replaced by sine of mu bar C over mu bar all squared. Now, we want to modify the interaction terms. And we don't really know how to deal with these at first, but it turns out that there's a very simple way to modify them so that your constraints are preserved by the dynamics. And that is to not modify these two terms at all, leave them as they were, and to put in a cosine of 2 mu bar c here on the matter term. And it's still an open question right now to me why this cosine of 2 mu bar c appears here, and if there's some heuristic argument that can show why it should appear. But right now, I don't have any strong answer to that. But your interaction on the gravitational side are unmodified. You just had this small modification here. No. Oh, okay, yes. So your second order terms contribute to the dynamics. So they're not, you don't constrain them to be zero. So it's only the linear terms which you constrain to be zero. But you need the second order terms to get your dynamics correctly. Right?
Even when you quantize it.
No, even classically. So if you want to calculate the dynamics, you take your Poisson bracket. So if you have, let's say, a square, then you'll get linear terms.
Sure.
So that's why you want the second order. So that's only important for the dynamics. For a constraint, you just want these three terms here to be equal to zero. But you need the extra two terms to get the correct dynamics.
And that cosine of 2 mu bar c, you have no reason to put it there.
Not right now. Right now, I'm putting it there because it works.
And the bounce happens where c is.
But zero
or what is
The bounce happens where mu bar c is equal to pi over 2.
Mu bar c is pi over 2.
Yeah. So here, you'll have a term which becomes, this is 1 classically and minus 1 at the bounce point.
So basically it says that your field has no gradient term at the point of the bounce.
At halfway to the bounce, actually.
Okay, so you said mu bar c is pi over 2, right? Oh, okay, yes.
Yeah.
So that means 2 mu bar c is pi, so cosine of pi minus 1. So no, but that's a bit weird. So you're changing the sign of gradient term versus the kinetic term.
Yes.
So isn't that like pathological? Like the
tachyonic
instability or something like that?
I don't know of any instabilities that arise, but I agree it certainly is weird.
No, but it is an instability, right? Because if that cosine wasn't there, then you had phi level that is Laplacian of phi is the field equation. Mm-hmm. But then if that cosine becomes negative, then you have the opposite sign, basically. Phi level that becomes negative Laplacian mm-hmm. of phi. So your dispersion relationship you have imaginary frequencies. So instead of oscillating modes, we have exponentially.
Right. So that actually, well, I haven't looked at the equations in great in enough detail, but at first it appears that that effect is canceled by another term, which appears from the other corrections. So I'll come back to that in a second.
The gravitational, do you mean?
Yeah.
Because it's just, if you just focus on the field, it seems that you have exponential instability as you go through the law.
Yeah.
You understand what
you're saying?
Yes.
I'll show you the equations at the end, and then we can talk about that a little bit more. Yes?
Is it possible the sine term gives you two turning points? So you would have, you know, a collapse from some large radius, and you have a nice...
No. If you have a collapse from... due to a closed universe, for example, which is entirely classical, then that will continue to happen. So you can have a cyclic cosmology with a bounce and a recollapse and a bounce and a recollapse. But you won't have that recollapse due to quantum effects. So that only becomes important if the curvature becomes large.
This looks a lot like polymer quantization, where you get a sine term like this in the semi-classical limit. And I think you can actually get that from an action then as well. So,
yeah, I think in the literature this is often called polymer quantization, but I don't know if it's the exact same, but I think it's quite similar.
I think if you discretize at the beginning, then your Hamiltonian gives rise to this sine term. It comes from an action, so it might be
okay.
Something to look into to
yeah.
See where you get that two cos or cos. Cosine pro.
That'd be interesting.
And so maybe you're about to say this, but if the constraints are preserved under the dynamics, which is disproportional to Hamiltonian constraint, you must know what's the Poisson bracket algebra of the Hamiltonian constraint itself.
Yes, that's just a Diffeo constraint.
It is.
Yeah. Well, there a multiple of the Diffeo constraint.
And these the insertions of the sine squared and the cosine don't affect that.
No, and that's why. This term here is absolutely necessary. If you just have one here, then it's no longer preserved. So if you just say, well, I'm just going to modify this, but not this, then you find that your scalar constraint is not preserved.
And is this still true in the discretization where the derivatives replace the parameter?
Yes, in the effective theory. In the quantum theory, I haven't shown that yet. But
in the
effective classical theory, yes. Okay, so a few comments just on the initial conditions. So first of all, the initial conditions have to satisfy the quantum corrected scalar and diffeomorphism constraints everywhere. So the sum of these three terms has to be zero, and also your Diffeo constraint, which hasn't been modified, also has to be zero. But if you choose your initial conditions far away from the Planck regime, so at curvatures which are much less than the Planck scale, then it's good enough to just impose the classical scalar and Diffeo constraints because they're excellent approximations. And then these quantum corrected equations of motion will make sure that the full quantum corrected constraints will hold at all times. And just as a short comment, your equations of motion are generated just by the sum of your homogeneous interaction terms. And what we have is for a massless scalar field. But it's very easy to generalize this for any perfect fluid, and I'll do that at the end. And that's when we'll be able to talk a bit more about the instability, or the potential instability. So this is what the Hilonic corrected equations of motion for the perturbations are. So you have these terms in red, which provide corrections. So this term classically is just 1. This term classically is just C. And these two terms, well, this is C, and this is c squared. And you can see that classically these two terms combine to give you minus 1/2 here. So this is just to show that the equations of motion change in a relatively simple way, but not necessarily immediately obvious. And also, as I mentioned earlier, these equations of motion ensure that if you start with initial conditions that satisfy the constraints, their time derivatives will be zero, so they're preserved. Okay, now to generalize this for a perfect fluid, your Hilonomy corrected effective equations have this form. So here you have your conservation equations, conservation of energy, conservation of momentum. So what we were talking about earlier, your conservation of energy is modified. There's this small correction here. But conservation of momentum is not. Is not modified, so it's exactly the same as the classical one. So it does seem, in some sense, that they're not as modified as your other terms here. You have your two Friedmann equations, which are both modified. And what you were worrying about, I think, is that if you just focus on the term, the cosine term, here you'd have 1 minus 2 rho bar over rho c. That would produce an instability. But because there's another term which comes out with rho bar plus p bar, the minus is canceling. You just have this plus p bar over rho c now. So the other term, will come from this part. I can show you through the derivation later if you wish. But okay. Or the next one.
So, I mean, the first line, the Laplacian, in front of it, you get the negative, basically, term,
yeah.
And you get close to the bound.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, so then if you derive the wave equation as a sound wave basic equation from that, then you would think it has, you get an imaginary speed of sound. So, and for that, I think you have to combine, I'm trying to see this equation, you have to combine. So you have to combine that equation I think, with the second equation. You combine first and
this
second.
This one here?
Yeah.
Okay.
If you have an equation of a state, like P and rho are somehow related to each other.
Mm.
Yeah, I think if you combine first and second equation, you should get the sum, basically the sum by equation. But then because you're changing the sign in front of a Gaussian, you should get. Well, but anyway, so you can solve this equation and see
yeah.
that there's an instability. Okay.
Yeah.
And you're going to show us what the solution is.
No, unfortunately, I can't.
Why not?
Well, I haven't begun that for you. So that's
some
stuff.
Okay. So there might still be an instability.
There might be. The I was talking with Robert Brandenburger, and he was very worried about minus sign being here, which it is if you look at it naively. But it turns out there's an extra term which cancels that out. So
well,
that's one potential.
The easier way to see this if you go back one page in your
yes.
own equation. So the first two equations,
mm-hmm.
they just give you the field equation for phi.
Yeah.
If you combine the first. And yeah, that gives you an imaginary the speed of sound if that cosine becomes negative. If, assuming that the
yes.
psi of p
yes.
are uniform, like if you ignore their.
Yeah.
So that's the thing to worry about.
Yeah.
Now, what's the consequence of the instability there? Doesn't it mean that you're going down from this effect?
But it's the cosine. Well, I don't think it's cosine is the right word. But it's not the kind that you can tolerate because it becomes faster on a smaller scale. So as soon as that sign changes, you're dead, basically.
Does it mean that you are going out of this regime? So you
well, linear theory breaks down, then you don't really trust it. So, right. So that's the problem. If it's instability in exponential growth in a very short time, then you don't trust linear theory. So, anyway, that would be my worry.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. So these are the, again, quantum corrected equations. And I already mentioned this, but just to repeat myself, what happens in a lot of these terms is that the sign reverses close to the bounds. So you have 1 minus 2 rho bar over rho c, so the sign will be reversing close to the bounds. And this could produce potential instabilities, which I need to look into. Now, another way of looking at this, in some sense, is that gravity becomes repulsive. So we definitely have this in the homogeneous case. There's the bounce. So gravity becomes repulsive, and that's what causes the bounce. Now, the question is, at first glance, it looks like that as well for the perturbations. This has to be verified. Maybe this is just damping out all the perturbations. So all overdense clumps become diluted. So that's what I see here, but I need to make this more precise.
But just to add that to that, mm-hmm. the general problem with having a bounce is that you can always add some weird exotic fluid that gives you a bounce. The problem is that you have to violate energy conditions. And those type of fluids that violate energy conditions, they usually have this type of problem that they have imaginary speeds of sound or some other pathology they have to go through. Yeah. So that's why this is the thing that you worry about, because you seem to be doing that. You, in a sense, you're saying you're modifying gravity, but in effect, it's like a modified fluid which violates, I think, non-energy condition. And usually
yeah.
when you violate non-energy condition, you worry that there's a ghost or instability or something. So
yeah. Okay, so let me conclude. So LQC, in the homogeneous case, naturally leads to a bouncing universe scenario. And now we have Polanyi-corrected effective equations for scalar perturbations, which will let us study the evolution of these perturbations through the bounds. As I mentioned at the end, gravity seems to become repulsive when your energy density is at the critical density divided by 2 in both the background and perturbation equations of LQC. I also want to mention that these Polanyi-corrected equations of motion, have also been obtained in a completely different approach, which is the approach that Martin uses, using just adding correction functions in your Hamiltonian. And this is a different approach. It's also gauge invariant. So my approach, you have to be in longitudinal gauge. In their approach, you can be any gauge. And if you take their results and you look at the longitudinal gauge, you'll find that the two equations are exactly the same. So this is a nice show that these results are robust. Now, of course, there's a lot that remains to be done. We have the equations. We need to study them now and see what they have to say. So the most important thing, I think,
is to gain a better understanding of how the physics changes near the critical density. Are there instabilities? What happens to your perturbations? Do your high density regions become less dense? And try and see what happens with that. Another thing which I think is important is to develop the quantum theory of lattice LQC. Here I've only talked about the effective model, which incorporates the most important quantum gravity effects. But it would be important to get the entire quantum theory so that we can try and learn from that about the full theory of loop quantum gravity, in particular the commutator of H with itself and H with the Diffie constraint and so on. And once we have this, then hopefully we can derive observational signatures of LQC, either obtaining subleading corrections for inflation or for the ekparotic case, or perhaps LQC is good enough by itself. But this is all work that has to be done. There's been some preliminary work in inflationary models, both with inverse triad corrections and with holonomy corrections. But there's been nothing done so far in either ekparotic, as far as perturbations are concerned, or perturbations in LQC alone to see if we get what we would like there. So a lot of work that's left to be done. And on that note, I'd like to thank you for your attention.
Do we have additional questions?
Maybe I'll ask one. So, this last line, how do you imagine setting the initial conditions for your?
Well, you have a contracting phase before. So we know that if you have a contracting phase, moderate matter-dominant contracting phase, and you get scale invariant perturbations in that regime, right? Then if you have radiation afterwards in that regime, you don't. But you do know what you have. And then going through the bounce, then you can see what happens to these different perturbations. So some which became large during the matter-dominant phase will be scale invariant, others won't be. And you can see how they all evolve and see, do they become scale invariant? Are those that are scale invariant lose that property? Those who aren't, do they gain it? This is stuff that we can look at.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
I don't remember the details, but Karam and Sheldon Guajo did study that question of whether there could be scale invariant perturbations in the quantum
technology
alone, and I don't remember the details at all.
Yeah, I forget exactly what he did, but I think he was using more heuristic arguments rather than his actual. I think now we'll have a more solid response. Maybe it will still be no. That's very possible. Then we'll have something much more solid.
There is a little period of. Some older models show that there's a little period of pre-inflation from the quantum cosmology from the bounce.
Yeah.
But they don't get more than QB fold.
Right. So if you're counting on e-foldings alone to give you your scale invariant spectrum, that's not going to happen, for sure. The question is, can the repulsive force through the bounce do it somehow? Because initially there was some hope that due to the bounce there's some early universe inflation, but as you say, it's very short, so it's not long enough to really give you scale invariant perturbations. But maybe this would be a different mechanism which could give it. But
do you have any kind of separation of scales that might lead to that?
I have nothing very strong. I think just the fact that gravity is repulsive maybe might kill off your perturbations. So you might have strong perturbations, and these are all wiped out by the repulsive effects, because your overdense regions lose their overdense property. But that's very hand-wavy. I want to think about this a lot more carefully. Yes?
So this quantum theory, what do you mean? This is a quantum theory of the linearized perturbation on the effective background?
So here, the quantum theory is lattice LQC. So each cell is homogeneous isotropic LQC.
So you would really, quantize again? No,
it's just one quantization, right? So you have...
Because the sine and the cosine? New corrections, they were like effective corrections from the background. Couldn't you take this this effective background as a classical background, and then just quantize the perturbations.
Yes. So.
And do some kind. And this would be kind of almost standard perturbation quantization.
Right. So that's actually that's what Abhay, Ivan, and Will are working on, but I'm not sure what the status is there.
Okay, that's why we're not. I mean, then you could ask some interesting question because we have a bounce, and basically the typical question would be how to choose a state.
What you can do here, what hopefully happens is that they do their model, which is basically what you're saying,
mm-hmm.
and I do this lattice version. We get the same effective equations at the end. And then, you know, depending on the question you're asking, you could use one setting or another in the quantum theory.
So you want to quantize both the perturbations and the background in each cell?
Right, so here what I would do is that each cell has P and C as its variables.
Okay.
So each cell is homogeneous and isotropic.
Yeah.
And then your interactions depend on the differences between P's and C's of neighboring cells.
And this P and C would be when you also quantize non-perturbatively.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So if you're hoping to get the spectrum of from LPC alone, what is the field whose fluctuations you're calculating if you don't have a scalar or something?
That's hard to say.
So in usual inflation, you have this perturbation of a scalar field, it's a local degree of freedom, and you calculate the fluctuations of that, and that's what seeds structure. What would, if you don't have that scalar field, what would play its role?
So here, I can just use the radiation fluid.
Okay,
so I have these equations of motion, which are good for any perfect fluid. So I can use a radiation fluid in particular. So if I say, near the bounce, assuming there's no inflaton or other scalar field, I can assume that the matter field can be well approximated by the radiation fluid. Because it's high energy, so you expect dispersion relation basically equals P, which gives you radiation. And then in that fluid, you have some perturbations, and you can see how they evolve.
Okay, so I suggest we thank Edward again.